Blog Talk Radio.
The Knights Templar, a holy order, God's personal militia. A society so secret that its true purpose is debated to this day. At first, glorified.
They would have been on a spiritual path.
And then, accused.
Blasphemy, sodomy, and devil worship.
Just who were the Knights Templar? Heretics? A brotherhood of treasure hunters? Or, as books like the Da Vinci Code suggest, the keepers of sacred knowledge? The Knights themselves left many clues, passed down from generation to generation, hidden in ancient manuscripts, and scratched into the stone walls of their prisons. Secrets waiting to be deciphered by those adept enough to crack the Templar Code. It has been nearly 1,000 years since the first battles were fought in what the Muslim East called Al-Hurub al-Salibiya and the Christian West called the Crusades, the Wars of the Cross. For 200 years, blood was spilled in the name of God. Lines were drawn, alliances formed, and enemies made that endure to this day. Out of the bloodshed came legends of heroes, martyrs, and sacred relics like the Spear of Destiny and the Holy Grail. But of all the stories, the most mysterious is the saga of the Knights Templar. Though what has emerged may be an amalgam of both fact and fiction, one thing is certain. Few rose to such powerful heights, or fell so quickly, or so far. It is during the Crusades that the story of the Knights Templar begins. In 1095, major powers clashed throughout the Mediterranean and along the European borders. The medieval Roman Catholic Church in the West, and in the East, the Orthodox Christians and the Islamic Turks and Arabs.
Christian kings were very aware that this new religion was encroaching on their territories. So there was a political aspect as well, that the Western powers wanted to keep their kingdoms intact.
From the beginning, the West has two goals: to block what is seen as an Islamic incursion into Christian realms, and to take back Jerusalem, which has been controlled by Muslims, first by the Arabs, then by the Turks, since the 7th century.
It was partially psychological, and the religious aspect of getting Jerusalem back into Christian hands. But there was also the threat of, as I say, the Seljuk Turks coming into Europe. So it was basically a preemptive strike against the Arab world. The repercussions were enormous, and it permanently changed relations between Islam and Christianity.
On November 27th, in the year 1095, Pope Urban II summons a council of clergy to Clermont, France. His speech will later be written down in several variations, but the main thrust is unequivocal. He exhorts Christians everywhere to rise up against the Muslims in the Holy Land. One account includes his call to let those who have been robbers now become knights.
It was the First Crusade, which left Europe in 1096, was known as the Passagium Generale, which meant general passage. And that essentially meant anybody could go, whether they're a professional soldier, a knight, or just local common riffraff.
The medieval Catholic Church offers a powerful incentive to those who join the battle. Called an indulgence, it ensures that the First Crusaders will be an especially ruthless group.
You would get what was essentially a get-out-of-jail-free card, which would absolve you of your debts, it would remove your crimes.
And a lot of people on the First Crusade were actually criminals. They were rapists, murderers, thieves. And they knew if they went on the Crusade, got to Jerusalem, that was it, their slate would be wiped clean.
Thousands respond to the call and take up the sword. What follows is 3 years of slaughter. The Western Christians are united with their Byzantine brothers from the East. The Turks, Persians, and Arabs, with their history of infighting, quickly lose ground. In 1099, the Crusaders capture the ultimate prize, the Holy City itself.
When the Christians captured Jerusalem, there was a bloodbath. And knights were wading knee-deep in, the horses were knee-deep in blood. And they slaughtered everybody, Muslim, Jew, Christian, without mercy.
With Jerusalem firmly in Christian hands, Western pilgrims begin traveling to the east in record numbers.
People particularly wanted to see sites like Bethlehem. They wanted to see where Christ had undergone his crucifixion.
But such travels are far from safe, no matter who officially controls the city.
What they hadn't counted on was most of the Crusaders, once Jerusalem had fallen, went home. So they had nobody to protect the city. Once you got outside of the city walls of Jerusalem, it was a bit of a wilderness. Really lawless and dangerous place, and just saying that robbers behind every bush, essentially.
It is at this point, around the year 1119, that the first members of what will become the Knights Templar come forward. The founder is Hugh de Payen, a wealthy nobleman from the Champagne region of France. A veteran of the First Crusade, with a reputation for both piety and bravery, de Payen offers to recruit 9 of his relations to protect the Christian travelers who will now be coming to the Holy Land.
The original purpose of the Knights Templars was to protect people traveling from the coast of the Mediterranean to the Holy Land.
So the idea was that you have these knights, professional soldiers, living as monks, protecting the roads, patrolling the roads.
This has been the long-accepted story of how the Knights Templar came to be. But today, that account is being questioned by scholars and historians.
The first written evidence of their founding was 70 years after it took place, so some of that may not be completely accurate.
9 rather elderly and middle-aged knights were hardly in a position to protect very much in the Holy Land.
Is securing the safety of travelers their real mission? What really draws the Templars to the East? Ancient secrets or rumors of treasure and hidden mystical powers?
They burrowed down for over 90 meters, straight down through solid rock. They knew precisely where to dig. Where did that information come from?
Of all the mysteries that surround the Knights Templar, the most baffling concerns their early years in the Holy Land.
The Templars went to Jerusalem somewhere around 1118, 1119, and then for 8 or 9 years completely disappeared from the scene. They were not heard from during this time.
They presented themselves to King Baldwin II, the king of Jerusalem at the time, and they were given what we might call today 5-star accommodation on the southeastern platform of the Temple Mount.
The Templars make their headquarters on what is thought to be the site of the biblical Temple of Solomon. Built in the first millennium BC and said to be overlaid with pure gold, it is built to house the Ark of the Covenant, the 10 Commandments, and the secrets of Solomon, known as the wisest of men. Though the original temple is destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BC, other holy structures continue to be built and rebuilt on the site, including the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and the Dome of the Rock.
It's a sacred area to Jews because that's where Abraham was about to sacrifice Isaac in the book of Genesis. It's obviously sacred to Christians because that's where Christ was crucified. And it's sacred to Muslims because that's where the Prophet Muhammad ascended to heaven. So you've got these 3 great religions all vying for the same spot, basically.
It is this sacred spot the Templars will occupy for the next 75 years.
They could have been based anywhere, really, but they chose the Temple Mount. And this could have been due to the mystique of Solomon's Temple, or it could have been another reason.
In accounts written long after the fact, it is claimed that the Templars' mission is to protect pilgrims traveling to the Holy Land. But there are those who doubt that story.
There doesn't seem to be a single written account, documented account, of anyone who ascribes guarding the roads to the Templars.
They must have been doing something other than protecting pilgrims, because nine guys just can't protect that many pilgrims.
What are the nine founding knights doing at the Temple of Solomon before they return to the West in 1128 and reemerge as a major medieval power? A clue comes to light in 1867 when a British archaeological team excavates under the site of the Temple Mount. The team uncovers tunnels extending vertically from the Al-Aqsa Mosque for some 25 meters, then fanning out under the Dome of the Rock, long thought to be the biblical site of King Solomon's Temple.
The tunnels were re-excavated at the end of the 19th, the beginning of the 20th century by Lieutenant Warren of the Royal Engineers. And he found Templar artifacts scattered about throughout the tunnels, parts of Templar spurs and various pieces of armament. Nothing large, but sufficient to indicate that the tunnels had been used by the Templars or excavated by them.
Why were they excavating under the Temple Mount? What could they have been looking for? Rumors throughout history have connected the Templars with both riches and sacred objects. A letter written in 1187 by a survivor of the Crusades claims the Templars had a piece of the true cross. Early Masonic leaders, writing in the 1800s, cite secret documents that allegedly link the Templars with the Ark of the Covenant and treasure buried in the Temple of Solomon. Modern conspiracy theorists most often claim the Templars were seeking sacred relics that the all-powerful Catholic Church would have given anything to possess or suppress.
Even during the time of the Templars themselves, Crusaders era, 12th, 13th century, there were rumors then too. Perhaps the Templars found the Ark.
You've got to remember that at this time, the relics were an industry unto themselves. The crown of thorns, the spear of destiny, perhaps the piece of the true cross. Any of these would have had great spiritual power, if not some kind of mystical, magical power.
But there is one sacred object above all others that has become intertwined with the mythos of the Knights Templar. It is first mentioned by the German poet Wolfram von Eschenbach. Writing in the 13th century, he claims that formidable fighting men, the Templeisen, guard an object many would die to possess, the Holy Grail.
The Holy Grail is quite specific to the crusading period. Every leading poet of the day was writing Grail romances. It was a huge explosion of Grail literature around the end of the 12th century and the beginning of the 13th. That's the sacred relic that the Templars are most associated with. First Grail romance was written by a man called Chrétien de Troyes, who lived in the city of Troyes, which is where the Templars essentially came from. We can date Chrétien's story of the Grail to about the 1180s. Towards the end of the Templars' time in Jerusalem.
But what exactly is the Holy Grail? It has long been thought to be the chalice that Jesus used in the Last Supper, which held the wine that was to symbolize his blood. But there are other theories.
It could be any number of things, including a vial of precious blood. It could be a blinding white light, some of the Arthurian accounts.
Some people would say that the Grail is essentially a Christianized version of the old Celtic cauldron of plenty.
It could have been a silver platter, a spear, a secret book. Some believe possibly the Gospel of St. John.
Then, of course, there's the widely known theory that the Grail was, in fact, the holy bloodline of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. The Grail was actually the womb of Mary Magdalene, that she married Jesus and they had her family. Gives the area covered in famously by books like the Da Vinci Code.
The Grail seems to have, in many of the stories, the ability to manifest in its own unique way to each person. There are as many Grails as there are Grail seekers. So when we say, did the Templars have the Grail? Which Grail?
Such mystical quests aside, there is a more earthly prize the Templars may have sought.
The prevailing theory is that they were archaeologists, essentially, digging under the Temple of Solomon for the treasure left there by the Jews after the invasions of the Romans in the year 70.
There's gold and jewels and precious metals and so on. That was hidden at the time of the Jewish revolt in 66 AD. It's never been seen since.
That theory gains credence in 1952, when one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, known as the Copper Scroll, is unearthed. Incised on sheets of hammered copper, it seems to list an inventory of treasure, itemizing some 200 tons of gold and silver.
This immense hoard of gold and relics and scrolls would have been just a priceless find. It would have meant a great deal of treasure and money for the people that found it, and it also would have been of immense historical significance.
Was this what the Templars were looking for? And did they find it?
Frankly, it's a matter of speculation. But what is known is that when they finished their excavations, they scurried back to Europe, all nine of the founding knights, at some considerable speed.
When they came back to Europe in 1128, they became very powerful and very rich in a very short space of time.
The Knights Templar, a holy order and a military force. It is a paradox without precedent.
This was a very new idea at the time. There never had been this idea of a praying monk or a priest taking up arms.
They are sworn to follow the religious precepts of poverty, chastity, obedience, and piety. But they are warriors as well. The most indomitable and bloody the medieval world has ever seen.
They weren't accepted by everybody. Certain writers thought they were, it was really strange to have military monks, monks who killed for Christ.
But when the founding Templars return from Jerusalem in 1128, they have a powerful patron to help overcome any objections.
St. Bernard of Clairvaux was the leading churchman of his time. He comes to the Templars' defense, sings their praises, writes a tract in their defense.
A Templar knight, Bernard wrote, is truly a fearless knight and secure on every side, for his soul is protected by the armor of faith, just as his body is protected by armor of steel. He is thus doubly armed and need fear neither demons nor men.
It was called A New Knighthood, his major work of telling about this new order.
Bernard, who later becomes a Catholic saint, has close ties to this new knighthood. He is the nephew of one of the nine founding knights from the Champagne region in France.
The first nine knights were very much a family affair.
They were all related by blood or by marriage.
It is these nine knights who make their headquarters at Jerusalem's Temple of Solomon, and it is from this sacred site that they take their name.
They were called the Templars because they have their base on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem by the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which to the Crusaders was known as the Temple of Solomon. The actual full title of the order is the Order of Poor Knights of the Temple of Solomon.
The symbols of the order reflect not the temple's riches, but the knight's humble origins.
The famous image that was the seal of the Templars was to show two knights on one horse. And that's a reference to when they began, they apparently didn't have any money. They were very poor.
But they would not remain poor for long. In 1129, the Knights Templar begin one of the most successful recruiting and fundraising campaigns in history. They reach out to noble families across Europe, those with land, fortune, or a son to dedicate to the cause.
Hugh de Payen gives a speech at Troy. St. Bernard of Clairvaux is there to back him up. And essentially, they're asking for donations, for money, for lands, for men, to help support the Christian kingdom of Jerusalem, which by this point is about 30 years old, but politically quite unstable.
Suddenly, with marginal publicity, they start to get grants of land in every part of Europe.
The King of Aragon, for instance, in his will, I think he died in around the early or mid-1130s, left large chunks of what we now know as Spain to the order. And all of a sudden they just had this, you know, vast tract of land. Again, this comes back to the idea that everybody, or at least most people, thought that they were a good thing to have this, you know, really crack squad of trained soldiers defending the Holy Land.
The Templars attract some of the best trained and most fanatical fighters of the Crusades.
To become a Knight Templar, you had to be nobly born of legitimate descent, and you already had to be a knight.
And you would have to give up all your property, your holdings, and things like that to the organization.
It is this kind of dedication that Bernard of Clairvaux has in mind when he writes that a handful of righteous warriors can vanquish the most overwhelming horde. In 1177, the Templars live up to that promise at the Battle of Mont Gisard against the renowned Muslim leader, Saladin.
In the Battle of Mont Gisard, Saladin had an immense army, and he was on his way to attacking Jerusalem.
Saladin, leading an army of more than 26,000 men, encounters the Crusader army of Baldwin IV, the Christian king of Jerusalem. Numbering only 500 knights plus supporting infantry, they are blockaded at Ascalon by Saladin's far larger force. Some 80 Templar knights ride to the rescue, but Saladin's men block them at Gaza. Seeing little threat from the paltry forces, Saladin literally turns his back on them and heads for Jerusalem. Along the way, he allows his men one of the indulgences of war.
He allowed his troops to fan out across the desert and plunder and pillage various villages, which was the sport, if you will, of the time. And the troops got too thin. They were isolated from each other. They were more vulnerable. And it made the entire army more open to attack.
With Saladin's men occupied, the Templars joined the other crusaders at Ascalon. Together, their small force moves up the coast. Near Ramla, they ambush Saladin's personal bodyguards, the fearsome Mamluks. With the rest of his army scattered across the desert, Saladin has no reinforcements. He is forced to retreat back to Egypt. It is as Bernard had foretold. Victory, he wrote, is not dependent on a big army.
For the Crusaders, this just proved their belief that the small forces, under the right conditions, could prove victorious against the larger enemy.
It is this concept of the specially trained and especially ruthless elite force that popularizes the Knights Templar.
You had to be a skilled fighter who had been trained in fighting on horseback in heavy armor since the age of about 7 or 8 years. These boys were not amateurs. They were dedicated full-time professional soldiers. And the Knights Templar became, in effect, the first standing army since the fall of the Roman Empire.
Now, today, we might think of them as elite special forces, the Delta Force or the British SAS.
Donations of land and treasure made to the new order ensure that the Knights Templar are among the best equipped of the Western forces.
They would go into battle on a war horse, they're known as destriers, these very large horses. Even the horses were trained to fight. They were trained the horse to kick and butt and bite.
They carried a large two-handled sword, usually a pommel sword, which could cut a man in half with one blow. They also carried battle axes, maces. They could wheel and turn at remarkable speed. And they were the equivalent of a modern tank battalion when they were fighting.
You've got a row of these guys charging at you. You turn around and run.
But it isn't just their weapons or their skill in battle that make the Templar such a formidable enemy. In scrupulously secret initiation ceremonies, Templar recruits swear oaths of obedience and loyalty unto death.
They had a rule, and it was a cardinal rule. You did not even consider breaking the rule of ever leaving the battlefield until the Templar flag went down, which was probably at the very end, if at all. You did not leave.
Part of their vows were that they would never accept ransom, so if they were captured, they faced either execution or a lifetime of slavery. So there was nothing to surrender for. So they fought to the death.
Even great Islamic leaders like Saladin were afraid of them, because they had a reputation of being suicidal. If they died in battle, they would go to heaven straight away. It's very much the same as sort of the Holy War idea today. The Templars have the same mindset, really, as modern terrorists, to some extent. They would go into the field, and that would be it. They wouldn't care if they came out alive or not. They were quite a scary bunch, really.
This cult-like fanaticism, with its oaths and secrecy, makes the Templars fearsome in battle. But it will one day precipitate their fall.
The Templars were probably the most secret of secret societies,
and they held these strange initiation ceremonies at night.
We know almost nothing about what went on behind the closed doors of Templar presbyteries.
The Knights Templar start with 9 noblemen in 1119. But by the time they reach their pinnacle of power in 1300, they number in the tens of thousands. There are Templar warriors in the east, and a massive support system of civilian Templars in the west. Together, they constitute an empire unrivaled in the medieval age, with riches beyond imagination, power without limit. Their rise is meteoric. It begins in 1128, just a decade after their founding, when the first Knights Templar returned to the West after 9 years in Jerusalem. With donations sparked by the patronage of France's revered cleric, Bernard of Clairvaux, they quickly raise a fortune and an army to join the front lines of the Crusades.
They were able to send 300 knights to the Holy Land within less than 8 months. Now, 300 knights possibly doesn't sound a lot, but with each knight there would have been a squire, there would have been horses, there were farriers, there were tradespeople and armourers to go with them, and all the transport had to be organised.
Fighting at the side of kings like Louis VII of France and England's Richard the Lionhearted, the Knights Templar play a critical role in the Crusades. Some protect their headquarters in Jerusalem. Others roam Europe and the Middle East, wherever battle takes them. There they serve as relief forces or guard the rear of the Crusader armies. And often, they are the battering ram used to break the enemy's ranks. From 1150 on, the Knights Templar no longer guard the road to Jerusalem. They have found a better way to protect the pilgrims along the route. An ingenious system that allows pilgrims to travel without the cash and valuables that might otherwise make them targets.
Before anyone would leave for crusade. Whether it was a pilgrim or a noble or a king, they often would leave their land deeds, their charters, their jewels, their family, heirlooms, precious items and objects in the Templar commandery closest to them. So they would go there, deposit their goods, and in exchange for that, they would receive a note written in cipher.
Every time you had to pay for something en route, you went to the local Templar commandery, who would pay the money for you, recode your chit, and you carried on. And when you came home, you brought your final chit back, and you either got a bill or the change. It was the charge card, American Express, writ large.
If they were robbed, or if it was found by an outsider, someone, it would be of very little value.
But the only way you could get the money out would be to crack the code. And the Templars, obviously, given their reputation for secrecy, were very good at keeping their own codes out of enemy hands.
The services the Templars offer become the model for today's banking system. Money transfers, credit and checking, safety deposit boxes, pension plans and wills. But their most controversial service is the issuance of high-profile loans.
They became bankers in a very, very big way. They lent to emperors, priests, bishops, kings. There was a church law against charging interest, so they didn't charge interest, they charged rent. It was a neat little euphemism to get round it.
Even with its strict laws against usury, the church looks the other way. It will be the first of many concessions made to the Templars. In 1139, Pope Innocent II, a former protege of St. Bernard, the Templars' patron, issues a declaration called a papal bull, which honors the Knights Templar with unprecedented privileges.
The Templars got an extraordinary package of perks from the Catholic Church. They were allowed to cross borders, which was a big deal back then. They were absolved from taxes. They were under no one's authority except the Pope himself, which was really an exceptional arrangement for the time.
What prompts the Church to grant this remarkable carte blanche?
The most reasonable explanation for all of these perks was simply as a thank you, if you will, for protecting the pilgrims. But I'm skeptical as to whether that was really the true purpose.
Some suspect that the autonomy granted to the Templars may not have been a reward, but a kind of hush money.
There were many possibilities for why this sweetheart deal was struck. It could have been that the church didn't want information to get out. The first theory about why this would have happened was that the Templars found extraordinary items and relics and scrolls underneath the Temple of Solomon. Scrolls that were not quite along lines of Catholic orthodoxy. For instance, the possibility of a more significant relationship between Jesus and Mary Magdalene, a different account of what happened with Jesus and the apostles, or anything that was a variation of what was in the approved canons of the Bible.
Whatever the reasons behind their new privileges, the Templars used them to amass greater power and influence in all aspects of life in the medieval world. They begin building churches and castles, buy farms and vineyards. They dabble in manufacturing and import and export trade goods. An elaborate hierarchy is formed. Each country has its Templar master, overseeing the master of each Templar headquarters or commandery, but ruling over all is the Templar Grand Master, elected for life, who controls both the military movements in the east and oversees the Templar holdings in the west.
All of their estates in Europe essentially were businesses that helped support the eastern end of things. So you see the Templars in Europe running farms, vineyards, tile factories, anything that can make money, they were in there.
It has been suggested that probably about 5% were even in places where battles were being fought. So a very small percentage were knights fighting Muslims. The vast majority of Knights Templars were part of the infrastructure that kept those knights fighting.
But even as the Templars' Western Empire flourishes, their efforts in the Middle East begin to unravel as rivalries spring up between the various Christian factions.
The Christians were disunified at each other's throats. You know, they'd been arguing for decades, basically, and it fundamentally weakened their position.
The turning point comes in 1187 in the desert beyond the Sea of Galilee. After a century of conflict, the stage is set for one of the most grueling and decisive battles of the Crusades. The Templar warriors will put their lives on the line and their fate in the hands of their commander, Gerard de Ridefort.
Gerard de Ridefort, who was the Grand Master of the Templars at the time, was a very hot-tempered and impetuous man, not awfully bright when it came to strategy.
Bound by their oaths of loyalty and blind obedience, the Templars are about to ride into battle, one that will spell the end of the Crusades and ultimately of the Templars themselves. July 4th, 1197. A battle is about to begin that will be named for the Horns of Hattin, the two rocky peaks that rise over the brush-covered slopes behind Tiberias on the Sea of Galilee. It will also become known as the turning point in the Crusades and in the lives and fates of a mysterious military order known as the Knights Templar. On that day, some 80 Templar knights, led by their Grand Master Gerard, merge with the rest of the Crusader army, a consortium of several different Christian factions. Estimated to be around 20,000 in number, they converge at a camp near Caesarea. Once again, they will confront Saladin, the great Muslim leader, who has laid siege to the town of Tiberias a day's march away. His army is only slightly larger, but he has more knights. The Christian forces have mostly foot soldiers. The Crusader leaders know they are at a disadvantage.
The Crusaders had a decision to make, whether or not to move their forces out to meet Saladin's approaching army, or to stay put and let the army come to them.
And the general consensus of the council was that it was high summer, the land was parched, and the safest and most sensible thing to do was stay in very easily defensible positions and let Saladin come to them.
But not everyone agrees. Among them is Gerard de Ridefort, who has risen to the rank of Templar Grand Master just 3 years before.
The Grand Master of the Templars would often do things contrary to what everybody else thought, just to get his own way and to stay in control.
Gerard is said to have long-standing grudges against some of his Crusader allies, personal prejudices that some will say color his actions on this day.
Because this idea of staying put had been put forward by his rival, he browbeat and bullied the entire assembly into deciding to march, not at night in the cool, but in daytime. And against a general of Salah ad-Din's reputation and skill, that was fatal.
The Crusader army begins the grueling desert march toward Tiberias without water or shelter. By evening, weak and disoriented, they are forced to make camp. It is then that Saladin's forces close in and surround them.
Saladin's forces set the brush in the desert on fire at night, causing lots of smoke and discomfort to the Crusaders and making their already parched existence even more unbearable.
In the attack that follows, the Christians are quickly decimated. It is the worst single military disaster in the Holy Land. The surviving Christian knights are sold into slavery. As is customary, the Templar knights are all put to the sword. But the Templar Grand Master, Gerard de Ridefort, breaks the Templar vow never to be taken alive. He allows himself to be spared and ransomed. A few months later, in the Battle of Acre, he is again captured and then beheaded. For the Christian crusaders, it is the beginning of the end. The remaining Templars are demoralized by the actions of their Grand Master. Morale is further undermined by rumors that the crusaders lost one of the most holy relics, a fragment of the true cross, in the battle. The tide has turned.
The Battle of the Horns of Hattin, which virtually destroyed the Holy Land as a kingdom, because Hattin meant the fall of Jerusalem would come very soon afterwards.
Saladin takes the city a few months later. Under Richard the Lionhearted, the Crusaders fight back. They retake the city in 1229, but hold it only briefly. In 1244, the Turks recapture Jerusalem and effectively end Christian rule. In 1291, the last Christian stronghold in Acre, an ancient seaport on Haifa Bay, finally falls. The loss of the Holy Land is devastating. Morale in the West is shattered. The subsequent crusades led by Louis IX of France and Edward I of England are failures. Some trace the loss back to the disastrous Horns of Hattin, which forever taints the reputation of the Templars.
After that, the reason for the Templar Order's existence was not as acute at all as it was before. From that point on, some felt, well, maybe God didn't bless the Templars as well as we had thought.
After the loss of the Holy Land, they were literally at a loss themselves, because everything was geared up to maintain an army in the field and to protect the Holy Land, and the Holy Land was gone.
16 years pass without conflict, though the new Templar Grand Master, Jacques de Molay, continues to agitate for yet another incursion into Jerusalem.
Jacques de Molay went around the crowned heads of Europe trying to create a wave of enthusiasm for a new crusade and found there were no takers.
After nearly 200 years of bloodshed, the crusades are over.
Once that happened, the whole reason for the Templars existing became something of a misnomer. There was no reason for them existing anymore.
Now, in this time of peace, the Knights Templar are about to pay a terrible price for their decades of privilege in one of the greatest public scandals of the day. It begins in October of 1307 on Friday the 13th, a day that will forever be considered unlucky. On that morning, Templar headquarters throughout France suddenly come under attack.
Troops all over France open sealed orders and arrested every Templar in sight. And they got a considerable number of them.
Among those arrested is the Templar Grand Master Jacques de Molay and a dozen of his leading knights. They are charged with capital offenses and their properties are seized. Are the Templars about to be the victims of a conspiracy? Have their fame and rumors of their treasure and sacred objects made them a target? Or are the shocking charges that are leveled against them really true? For nearly 200 years, this secret religious and military order of warriors and power brokers has used the Crusades as a springboard to gain unprecedented power and privilege.
They've been described as a church within a church and a state within a state. They were completely autonomous. They were answerable to nobody except the Pope himself.
But all that is about to change. The King of France, Philip IV, called Philippe le Bel or Philip the Fair, has summoned Templar leaders from throughout Europe to his kingdom. He calls a meeting to discuss a possible merger of the Templars with other military orders. The Templars' supreme commander, Grand Master Jacques de Molay, has no choice but to respond.
De Sir Molay came and brought a very large number of knights with him and a large treasure train, and arrived in Paris in 1307, and was greeted by King Philippe le Bel.
But the meeting is only a pretext, one designed to lure all the high-ranking Templars to France. Those they leave behind are now without real leadership, and it is at this moment that the king strikes.
On Friday the 13th of October 1307, the Templar knights who were in France at the time woke to find the soldiers of the king knocking on their doors.
In Paris and in the Templar commanderies all across France, Templar leaders are rounded up, imprisoned, and charged with high crimes.
It was well in excess of 100 charges altogether.
Denying Christ, spitting on the cross, urinating on the cross, practicing institutionalized homosexuality and devil worship. It was pretty fashionable to charge people with devil worship at the time.
The charges are familiar. They had been leveled against Pope Boniface VIII just 4 years before by King Philip, who sought a pope more in line with his own agenda.
And the inquisitors basically did what we would call today a cut and paste. Move it, change a few words, call it new charges.
However flimsy the pretense, the arrests come at a time when the Templars and their Grand Master are vulnerable. It has been 16 years since the last disastrous battles in the Holy Land, when Jerusalem fell back into Muslim hands.
Gradually, over a fairly protracted period of time, Christianity lost its hold on the Near East and on the Holy Land. Once that happened, the whole reason for the Templars existing became something of a misnomer, and really there was no reason for them existing anymore.
A standing army, without a base and without a battlefield. It is a prospect that makes rulers throughout Europe uneasy, especially King Philip.
A few years before 1307, he had inherited the lands of Champagne. That's where the headquarters of the Templar Knights were. He was worried that the Templars might want to found their own land south of his, and he didn't want a huge Templar state right on his own doorway.
King Philip may have other personal reasons to move against the Templars.
France was very poor during the reign of Philip IV. His father had spent tremendous amounts of money on war, and in fairness to Philip, he did inherit a very poverty-stricken nation.
He owed the Templars an enormous amount of money for a variety of failed military operations that he'd gone through.
And he saw that by destroying the Templars, he would not have to pay them that money back.
Overnight, nearly every Templar leader in France is imprisoned. The Grand Master, Jacques de Molay, appeals to the papacy, which has championed the order for nearly two centuries. But the reigning Pope, Clement V, headquartered in France under the protection of King Philip, is in no position to help.
They were childhood friends. Bertrand de Gotte, as the Pope's name really was, had been raised with Philip. He was elected simply because Philip wanted him elected. And also, he wasn't allowed to be a Pope in Rome. He had to be a Pope in France.
There will be no papal clemency. Though the Pope writes letters to the King questioning the arrests, he takes no further action. The fate of the Templars is now in the hands of the Inquisition. Mobilized in 1229 by the Church to root out heretics in southern France, the medieval Inquisition is a group of experienced interrogators and clergy, placed at the disposal of any European monarch who enjoys papal favor.
The main rule for the Inquisition was not to draw blood, so they could do pretty much anything except cut somebody, so they would do things like hold people upside down, or use cold water, or thumb screws, or a really nasty device called the strappado.
You would be hoisted up with ropes until your shoulders dislocated from the weight of your own body. Other ones would have been toes, feet roasted over a slow fire.
Over the next 5 years, the Inquisition's tactics prove effective. Figures cited in a trial transcript indicate that of the 138 Templars questioned in Paris, 105 admit they denied Christ during their secret Templar initiations. 103 confess that an obscene kiss was part of the ceremonies. And 123 say they spat on the cross.
A lot of the accusations against the Templars concern what went on in their initiation ceremonies. It's because the Catholic Church only allowed certain kind of rituals to be performed within the church and only by priests. So any rituals conducted outside of that were technically illegal within the church. And that was used as a reason to persecute the Templars.
Outside of the confessions, there is no proof of wrongdoing, no physical evidence, and no witnesses.
The thing that makes you vulnerable about being a secret group that has a secret ritual is that because it's secret, outsiders can make up anything about those rituals, and they usually make up the worst possible scenarios.
Anybody under the sort of torture that the Inquisition inflicted would have confessed to anything.
Jacques de Molay confessed pretty much straight away, but he was almost certainly tortured, and then about 2 months later retracted his confession, saying, no, it's all... none of it's true. I was being tortured.
The Inquisitors demand de Molay confess again publicly, but the Grand Master refuses.
With immense courage, he stood up, repudiated his previous confessions, which had been extracted by torture, and defended against all charges. And for that, of course, he had to die.
On March 18th, 1314, the Grand Master and Geoffrey de Charnay, the Templar Master of Normandy, both proclaim their innocence. That evening, around 6 p.m., a fire is kindled near the River Seine.
They weren't burnt at the stake, as most people believe. They were cooked very slowly over a slow fire.
So he would have taken several hours to die.
And then the ashes of their body were pounded up and spilled into the River Seine, so there would be no relics left for people to venerate. A most unpleasant business.
Legend records the final words of the Templar Grand Master, Jacques de Molay.
Before he died, he cursed the King of France and the Pope.
King Philippe le Bel and Pope Clement should join him before his creator, before the year was out.
A month later, the Pope died, and Philip the Fair was dead by the end of November. He died in a hunting accident, so he was quite a young man, actually.
Is the fulfillment of de Molay's dying words a sign of divine justice, or proof of the Templars' demonic powers? It is just one of the questions that will be explored throughout the centuries to come. A more immediate concern for both King Philip and the many treasure hunters who will come after him is this: where are the Order's considerable riches?
The most interesting thing about what happened when Philip's men broke in to all the Templar properties throughout France was how little they found there.
In their earliest days, they were called the Poor Knights of the Temple of Jerusalem. Individually, they were without possessions. But collectively, the Order of the Knights Templar was richer than any king. The Order paid no taxes and took in unlimited donations of land and riches from those who wished to be assured a spot in heaven. At their height, Templar wealth and power changed the very face of the medieval world.
Anytime you see a place that has temple in the name across Europe, and there are hundreds of these sites, that's a former location of the Knights Templar.
There were up to 15,000 Templar houses at one time at their peak.
Every town had a Templar presence. Everyone knew who they were. A lot of people did business with them, either because they were working on Templar farms or in Templar vineyards or keeping their life savings in their Templar account. So they were really part of the fabric of life of that period.
The Templars operate a fleet of ships, a personal trade route for goods and passengers between the West and the East. They own land, run farms, mills, and vineyards.
The Knights Templar was the first Western multinational corporation, and they certainly were the first banking group in the West.
It is these transactions that the Templars are best known for, offering the modern-day equivalent of traveler's checks, safety deposit boxes, letters of credit, and large cash loans.
They became bankers in a very, very big way. They lent to emperors, priests, bishops, kings. They would lend money to anybody who needed it. There was a church law against charging interest, so they didn't charge interest, they charged rent. It was a neat little euphemism to get round it. The name of the game was profit.
But the Templars were said to have two kinds of treasure. One was an earthly treasure of gold and jewels. The other, a sacred treasure, culled from years in the Holy Land, when the order was headquartered in the ruins of the Temple of Solomon.
When the Christians took over the city, there was much exploration of some of the sites that most Christians had been denied access to. And it is a genesis of some of the stories about the Knights Templar being really archaeologists.
To this day, tales persist of the Templars finding sacred relics, pieces of the true cross, the Ark of the Covenant, the Holy Grail, the divine remains of saints. Is there any evidence that the Templars possessed such objects? Some see a clue in a close reading of the confessions extracted from the Templars. Of more than 100 charges leveled against them, most are generic, accusations that would be used time and again in other trials. Witchcraft, blasphemy, sodomy, defaming the cross. But one allegation is unlike the others and remains associated only with the Templars.
They were accused of worshipping a head.
Everything ostensibly from a bearded head to a three-sided head to a talking head.
That was something that was unique for the Templars, which suggests there was something there.
What was this mysterious head? Descriptions differ as to whether it was a painting, a carving, or actual remains.
That ties in also with the belief about relics and the inherent power of a saint's energy after death to reside in the relic. Therefore, they carried some of the relics ahead of them in battle, believing that the power of that saint would come before the... Many medieval armies did that.
But some suspect that the relic was not from just any saint, but from perhaps the most famous saint of all.
Now, some people have seen that's the head of John the Baptist.
At this time in our history, we believed that various body parts of anybody famous had magical powers. So since John the Baptist was beheaded as part of his death, that was a very significant relic. And people wanted to have that head as some kind of symbol of their power or their strength. In fact, there are several organizations today that say they actually have the head still preserved now for 2,000 years. In Antioch, in Rome, in southern France, we don't really know.
Did the Templars have the real head of John the Baptist? One 12th century painting found on the wall of a Templar building in Temple Combe, southern England, is thought by some to depict the relic.
And if you care to look very carefully at the painting here at Temple Combe, you will find it looks like a disembodied head. It is white, it is dead, it is staring, the jaw is dropping. There is no neck visible. It looks like a head on a plateau.
Is this an eyewitness depiction of the severed head of John the Baptist? Or does it, as some believe, depict an even more sacred face? The one seen on the Shroud of Turin. The shroud, as it is traditionally folded, leaves only the face, the head, visible. And some believe the shroud may have been just one of many relics the Templars brought back from the Holy Land.
They might have discovered that during the sack of Constantinople in 1204, during the Fourth Crusade.
Retrieved this from the East, brought it back to Europe, and used it as part of their rituals.
What is it King Philip was looking for when his soldiers made their notorious raids on Friday the 13th? Is it the contents of the Templar banks? The treasure from the Temple of Solomon? Or the priceless sacred relics, like the Shroud of Turin, that they might have brought back from the Holy Land? Whatever their real goal, there is little evidence the king gained much from the arrests.
King Philippe didn't benefit as much as he thought he might have done. Obviously, his considerable debt to the Knights Templar was wiped out. But it certainly didn't solve his financial problem.
In an edict issued by Pope Clement V in 1312, the order of the Knights Templar is dissolved. But the Pope decrees that most of the Templar lands and holdings are given to other religious orders, not to the king.
Philippe the Bel managed to acquire some of them, but only enough to justify his bill for the cost of imprisonment and torture of the Templars.
The most interesting thing about what happened when Philip's men broke in to all the Templar properties throughout France was how little they found there. Not just in terms of personnel, but in terms of goods. They found virtually no money. The records of the order seem to have disappeared.
The Shroud of Turin does turn up some 40 years after the king's death in Liray, France. It is said to be produced by an old French family by the name of de Charnay. It is a name the king, had he lived, would have known.
Interestingly, the first family to exhibit a shroud in France in the 1350s were the de Charnay family. And Geoffrey de Charnay was the preceptor of Normandy. He was burnt at the stake along with Jacques de Molay.
But what happened to the rest of the relics, the treasure and the cash the Templars were said to have? The answer may lie with a group about which little is known, the Templar survivors.
The orders were issued on the 12th of October that they were all to be arrested at dawn on the 13th of October, but word leaked out before that. The majority escaped.
The prison tower of Chinon in the Loire Valley of France. It is here that the Grand Master and other leaders of the Knights Templar languish for years. Tortured by the Inquisition, reviled by the Christian countries they championed during the Crusades, they face life in prison or a slow death by burning.
Enigmatic symbols. Hearts, stars of David, geometrical patterns, grids. It's documentable. It's definitely connected to the medieval Knights Templar.
To this day, they have never been deciphered. But if this is their final coded message, what does it mean and who is it for? Is it for the Templars who have been left behind, leaderless after the arrests of 1307? Are the Templar masters leaving them instructions for a final mission, or a map to where the Templar secrets and Templar treasure may be hidden?
After the official suppression in 1312, there were still a number of Knights Templar that were left, that never were tried. There were thousands of them.
An incredibly small percentage of the Knights Templar, both knights and everybody else within the organization, was captured in 1307, probably not even a tenth.
Most of the Templar arrests are confined to France and England. In other parts of Europe, they fare much better.
Most other countries at first were very reluctant to prosecute.
But it did vary from area to area, depending on the strength of the church.
Those that do try the Templars rarely find them guilty.
one trial in, I think it was in Bavaria, which was attended by a troop of fully armed Knights Templar. They were found not guilty, not to anybody's great surprise, because the idea was if you find us guilty, we'll kill you.
Of the hundreds, possibly thousands, of Templars who remain free, there is little record. Some retire or join other orders. In Portugal, where Templar built towns and castles held off the Moors for decades, they simply changed their name from the Knights Templar to the Knights of Christ.
After the order was dissolved, the Portuguese king allowed them to carry on as the Knights of Christ, but they were basically all Templars.
Even in France, where the prosecution is the most vigorous, many Templars escaped the mass arrests.
Very few Templars, relatively, were captured or imprisoned. Most escaped. In France, which is where the majority of the high-ranking Templars were located, only about 620 of 3,000 were captured.
But where did they go? And did they take the Templar treasure with them?
The most likely explanation is that slowly but surely they drifted away through eastern France up into the mountains.
In the 1300s, this mountainous region is only sparsely populated with small communities of farmers and shepherds.
Many of the trade routes from France went straight through the Alps, through that region, which we now call Switzerland. The Templars knew this region extremely well. They'd been using it for well over 100 years. But it was almost impassable, and many hiding places with little isolated communities where normal armies would not be able to operate. Nowhere would have been better for hiding what remained of the Templar treasure than in that region.
While there is no proof of the Templars escaping into the Alps with their treasures, it is interesting to note that the villagers in the region were undergoing a transformation about the same time the Templar order fell from grace.
Around exactly the same time as Jacques de Molay, the last of the leaders of the Templars, was being burned in France, three small regions in what we now know as Switzerland were gathering together to fight against their overlord.
Duke Leopold I of Austria, who wants control of the Gotthard Pass as a shortcut to Italy, sends some 5,000 heavily armed knights to secure the region. But an ambush is waiting. Some 1,500 peasants block the route and attack from above, crushing the far larger force.
They became the most feared fighting men in Europe. But before that point, there's no evidence whatsoever that there were anything other than farmers. The Swiss had absolutely no military experience until that point.
Though the villagers undoubtedly used their innate knowledge of the mountain terrain to their advantage, some suggest they had another secret weapon.
There are folk tales from the period that say that armed white knights came to help them in the battles they fought.
Could they have been the remnants of the Knights Templar? If so, Switzerland may have proved the perfect place for both the Templars' military skills and business acumen.
We find people who had been fairly primitive farmers quite quickly turning themselves into seasoned soldiers and forging communities in which banking and proto-engineering were taking place. Really, there can be no coincidence.
The Knights Templar are considered by some to be the world's first bankers. Perhaps it's a calling they never abandoned. Did the Templars and their descendants found the Swiss banking system? One thing is certain, the Swiss themselves will never tell.
One of the things that really sets Switzerland apart, and always has, right from its inception, is just how secret it is. The banking systems that were set up in Switzerland are not like those in other parts of the Western world. They are as pathologically secretive now as they were, which makes them exactly the same as the Templars.
Is this where the trail ends? Most Templar treasure hunters don't think so. The Templars, they note, did not have to escape over land. They had an entire fleet of ships at their disposal, ships they had been using since the 1200s to transport people and trade goods between the West and the Holy Land.
We actually don't know how many ships they had. One thing we do know is that when the order fell in 1307, the entire fleet vanished.
For centuries, one of the greatest mysteries surrounding the Knights Templar has been the fate of their fleet of ships.
The Templars started out by taking their own knights and personnel to the Holy Land, but it must have soon occurred to them that they were coming back a lot of the time with fairly empty ships.
The trade route started to develop. They were bringing all sorts of other merchandise back and forth as well.
The Templars themselves had fleets that traded all over Europe with England, France, Italy, Spain, with the Holy Land.
Documents from around 1207 indicate the Templars already had their own ships and were starting to build an entire fleet. One account from October 12, 1307, reports the presence of 18 Templar ships anchored in the port of La Rochelle off the French coast. The next day, they are gone.
And we don't know where the ships went to or what they were carrying.
The Templars could have taken the treasure in their fleet almost anywhere.
One likely escape route is to the north, to one of the longest-held Templar strongholds.
A lot of them would have fled to Scotland, which was the one country where they were completely safe at that time.
There was little chance the Scots would have honored the order from the Pope disbanding the Templars. Because of the actions of the Scottish king, Robert the Bruce, in 1306, the same Pope who condemned the Templars also decreed that Scotland was no longer a part of the Catholic Church.
Robert the Bruce had killed a rival in church. He had been excommunicated. The Pope had expected that his barons would rise up against him. They didn't, so they were excommunicated. The country didn't rise up either, so the entire country had been excommunicated.
Robert the Bruce declares war against the British at a time when the Templars have little reason to love England, where their leaders have been arrested. In 1314, legend has it, they join Robert the Bruce in his fight for independence.
There is a long-standing legend, which I think is a reflection of fact, that at the Battle of Bannockburn, the charge that saved the day for Robert the Bruce was a charge of Knights Templar. And if one does not believe that, then one has some explaining to do, because the English army, which outnumbered the Scots by about 3-1.
To date, no record has been found describing the fate of the Scottish Knights Templar. But those hunting such evidence and other Templar secrets have one spot they would like to explore. It stands on the estate of Scotland's oldest and most powerful clans, the Sinclairs, or as some translate the name, St. Clair, the family that plays a key role in the Da Vinci Code.
The Sinclair family has long been associated with the Templars because they were one of the first families to give land grants to the Templars when they came back from the Holy Land in the 1120s.
Today, many Sinclair descendants claim Templar ancestry.
Some have said that the Sinclair family were masters in Scotland of the Templars, but we don't have any documentation. Whatever the true relationship is between the Sinclairs and the Templars, whether it was just a sponsorship or something much more deep, they've always been closely linked.
It is here at Roslyn Castle that some believe the Templars fled to conceal their relics and their records. Built by the Sinclairs in the 1100s for more than 200 years, the castle served as a regional repository of medieval knowledge.
What was called a scriptorium in ancient times, which is like a place where books were copied by monks, like in calligraphy, Roslyn was a center of learning, And in that sense, it would be like a very important college or a library today.
In 1546, Mary of Guise, the Queen Regent of Scotland and mother of Mary, Queen of Scots, writes an enigmatic letter to Lord William Sinclair of Rosslyn, in which she makes reference to a great secret within Rosslyn. This has been interpreted by some as a reference to religious relics and Templar treasures from the Holy Land. Most of the speculation centers not on the ruins of Rosslyn Castle, but on an adjoining structure the family commissioned in 1446. Built by skilled stonemasons, who some believe were the precursors to the Masonic guilds that emerged later, Rosslyn Chapel is covered in carvings thought to contain coded messages.
There are Templar symbols in the chapel. There are Masonic symbols in the chapel. There are traditional Christian symbols, of course, around the chapel. There are what would the church would call pagan symbols in the chapel.
The bizarre symbols have some convinced that the chapel marks a crypt where secret religious documents, including Templar artifacts, may be buried. It is a suspicion that inspired one group of investigators to begin an ad hoc excavation in the late 1990s.
About 10 years ago, a group bought the lot adjacent to the chapel and actually hired drilling crews to come in to dig diagonally down into the crypt. The fascination with this crypt has been intense.
Scotland's Historic Preservation Council put a swift end to the attempt, and no plans have been made for further excavation. Some are even calling for the site to be closed, worried that Da Vinci Code fanatics may soon overrun the 500-year-old building.
Digging underneath Rosslyn Chapel is really a lose-lose for the chapel. If they dig and they find something of importance, there are going to be millions of people who want to see this, and the building itself will be in danger because of potential damage. If they dig and they don't find something, the tourists will stop coming, and it will endanger the restoration effort that they're going through right now to preserve the building.
The conflict over Rosslyn is not an isolated case. Treasure hunters continue to dig wherever they suspect Templar gold may be hidden. At one site, the excavation has been going on now for more than 200 years. Hundreds of thousands of dollars have been spent, lawsuits filed, and lives lost, and there is still no end in sight.
It's really part of the genius of burying something underground, especially if it's in a structure, because what it takes to actually excavate something like that is a tremendous amount of will.
In 1314, the Knights Templar, one of the medieval world's most powerful and secret societies, disappears from the historic record. At the same time, the ships, documents, and treasure they are said to possess also go missing. After 150 years at the very pinnacle of power, Templars seem to vanish into a void. A void that may be in part their own making.
It involves a very incalculable loss, a very tragic one for historians. We simply do not have the Central Templar Archive. It disappeared after the suppression, 1312.
There are some reports that Jacques de Molay, the Grand Master himself, may have ordered a cache of Templar records burned shortly before the arrests.
You would have thought that if they were a good, an orthodox outfit, they wouldn't have anything to hide.
When so much has been lost, it is inevitable that attempts will be made to fill the void left behind.
There are hundreds of theories about the Templars. Some of them really grounded in the research and what we know, some a little bit more speculative, and some way out there.
Some believe that the Templars had the navigational skills to take their treasure and escape almost anywhere.
They would be sailing everywhere within the Mediterranean, because it's at the far end of the Mediterranean that we find the Levant, the Holy Land. But we know they were also to be found in the Baltic. They sailed up into the Black Sea. They almost certainly sailed in the Arabian Sea. They were travelling beyond the Pillars of Hercules, around Britain and Ireland. And it's a fair bet that they were also travelling across the Atlantic.
One theory has the Templars, outcasts in Europe, turning their ships toward the New World and following ancient Viking routes into the North Atlantic, where island hopping could have kept them always within 200 miles of land.
We know the Templars were excellent sailors. They were drawn in part from the Normans. The Normans are always thought of as being French, but actually the word Norman comes from Norseman. And these were people from Norway, Vikings, who had conquered parts of France two or three centuries earlier.
It's this kind of speculation that leads Templar treasure hunters to extend their search to some unlikely and isolated spots, like Oak Island, just off the eastern coast of Nova Scotia, in Canada's Mahone Bay. There, stories of a legendary money pit has sparked debate for decades. The story, though told in many versions, begins the same.
In 1795, three teenagers on an island off the coast of Nova Scotia found a hole, and above it a pulley and a rope, and they assumed they had stumbled upon a great treasure that had been buried there years before.
Curious, and hoping the spot might hold pirate treasure, the explorers begin to dig.
As they dug down into the hole, they found evidence that it was a man-made structure. They found logs in certain patterns. They found fill that had been put in place.
Though reports vary, the most common claim is that the pit contains layers of logs and stones placed at 10-foot intervals. The teens eventually give up on the pit, but in the 1800s, three different treasure hunting consortiums each begin new excavations there. Somewhere in this time period, a stone covered with coded symbols is said to be found, though it has since vanished. Further digging yields only seawater.
When they got down below 90 feet, the tunnel itself began to flood. They tried to pump it out, but just more water would come in.
An ingenious booby trap is sprung. The treasure hunters breach a hidden waterway stretching 500 feet from the pit and into a nearby cove.
The shaft was designed in such a way that if you dug deep enough and breached it, it would flood with seawater and fill up the hole. The only way to recover this treasure or whatever's down there would have been to know exactly where the tunnel was and know how to dig around it.
Though it has been said to contain everything from Captain Kidd's treasure to the Holy Grail, descriptions of the pit's elaborate engineering and mysterious carved symbols convince many it is of Templar origin.
Whoever designed and engineered this pit had to have some exceptional knowledge of structural design.
Though some maintain that the money pit is nothing more than a sinkhole, thousands of dollars are spent and six lives are lost in the years since its discovery. The first worker dies in 1861 when a boiler explodes. A second treasure hunter falls to his death in 1887. And in 1965, four workers die when they are overcome by fumes in the tunnel. Legal wrangling between two Oak Island property owners bring exploration to a halt in the 1990s. But the impasse may be about to end.
Two men now in their 80s have recently agreed to resolve their years of arguments and have decided to sell the island to new interests. And so a whole new generation of people are going to be looking around for that treasure.
The saga of the Oak Island treasure, like the legends of the Templars themselves, refuses to die.
In terms of the medieval era, the mysteries of the Templars just won't go away. They were the rock stars of their time. They were famous, they were powerful, and they disappeared. And we're just very anxious to know what happened to them.
It's a fascination that has only grown during the last two centuries. In the 1800s, the Masonic guilds of skilled craftsmen
adopted the Templars as their own. They incorporated Templar symbols and traditions into their own secret ceremonies, purposely blurring the line between the Templars and Freemasonry.
A lot of the Masonic movements claimed Templar pedigree, saying we're descended from the Templars or we're the new Templar. It was kind of in the air in the 18th century. A lot of anybody who was anybody was claiming to be a Templar or a, you know, descended from that tradition.
Others have mined the Templar legends as well. In the 19th century, Sir Walter Scott portrayed them as villains in Ivanhoe. In the 1960s, Satanist Aleister Crowley claimed them as fellow devil worshippers. A decade later, the Templars rose from the grave as zombies in a series of Italian horror films. Most recently, the Templars have been portrayed as misguided zealots in movies like Kingdom of Heaven, and used as a plot device in blockbusters like National Treasure and The Da Vinci Code. The renewed interest has led to everything from Templar video games to hardcore punk music.
It's almost like every age has their own spin on the Templars, and that's sort of a reflection of that particular age.
Why, after more than seven centuries, does the investigation and the speculation continue?
Because the human animal loves a puzzle, loves a mystery, and loves drama. And here is a story where you have a mysterious founding of an order who are incredibly brave, financially astute, incredibly powerful. Then they are suppressed in scandal. They end up being burnt at the stake or cooked over a slow fire.
A lot of it has to do with the loss of the central archive, because we don't have the essential records that were there that could answer these questions definitively.
This leaves a vacuum, and the myth makers and the fantasists have been having a field day ever since.
Journey back to medieval times when church-appointed knights terrorized their foes, amassed a huge fortune, and may have indulged in forbidden rites. Who were these monks who killed for Christ? The Holy Land, venerated by Christians, Muslims, and Jews. At the end of the 11th century, its sacred soil ran with their blood. In the year 1096, Pope Urban II sent an army of crusading knights from Western Europe to capture the birthplace of Christianity from its Muslim overlords, the Saracens. It was said that as the victorious knights rushed to pray at the tomb of Jesus, they waded ankle deep through blood. By the year 1100, the Crusaders ruled lands stretching from the Sinai Peninsula to northern Syria. Jubilant pilgrims, eager to worship at their holy places, made the long journey to these ancient kingdoms, believing the Crusaders would protect them from thieves and Saracens. But the Crusaders could not help them.
They captured Jerusalem and the associated holy places. They didn't have enough manpower really to occupy Palestine and Syria effectively. So it was really rather dangerous if you were a pilgrim traveling about the roads of Palestine.
In the year 1118, a group of nine knights presented themselves to Baldwin II, leader of the Crusades and king of Jerusalem. Led by a French nobleman named Hugh de Payen, these nine knights would swiftly grow into one of the medieval world's most powerful and controversial organizations. They called themselves the Poor Knights of Jesus Christ.
Certain noblemen of high rank, devoted to God, professed a wish to live in chastity, obedience, and without property. The first element of their profession was that they should protect the roads and routes to the utmost of their ability against the ambushes of thieves and attackers, especially in regard to the safety of pilgrims. Archbishop William of Tyre.
King Baldwin offered the poor knights lodgings in an unused wing of his palace on Jerusalem's Temple Mount. The Crusaders believed this had once been the site of ancient Israel's Holy of Holies, the Temple of King Solomon. It was not long before the Poor Knights of Christ acquired a new name, the Knights of the Temple of Solomon, shortened to Knights of the Temple, or Knights Templar. Soon all of Christendom would know them and regard them with a mixture of curiosity and awe. The medieval world had never known anything like the Knights Templar. Like monks, Hugh de Payen and his Templars took vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. They rose before dawn to pray and took their simple meals in silence. The official seal of their new order bore a striking image of humility, two poor Templars sharing the same horse. Hardly the icon of proud crusading knights. Yet the Templars were devoted to war. Hugh de Payen and his nine knights guarded the pilgrim routes with a skill and ferocity that would make the Templars feared and respected throughout the Middle East.
What is so unusual about these orders is that they were men of religion, they'd taken the regular vows of any monk, and yet they were allowed to kill. This is the first time this ever happened.
The Templars' strange dual identity puzzled their fellow crusaders. Many wondered if perhaps these fighting monks had some other hidden mission. The fact that the Templars held all of their meetings in secret made them even more intriguing and gave birth to speculations which have endured to this day. Some said that the Templars were secretly digging beneath their living quarters at the site of Solomon's temple, perhaps hoping to discover Solomon's fabled treasure, the Ark of the Covenant, or even the Holy Grail.
They seem to have cleared a fairly large area underneath the Temple Mount in what was, it's claimed, the stables of Solomon's temple. What they were doing there and what they found, nobody knows.
It's a mystery whether the Templars excavated anything under Solomon's temple. There isn't any sign that there was any digging that took place there. It was a sacred site. I doubt very much they would have dug into it.
Were the Templars a shadowy sect on a clandestine quest, or were they simply pious soldiers of Christ? However humble their beginnings, theirs would be an extraordinary destiny. In its first 8 years, the fledgling orders of the Knights Templar lacked money and recruits and struggled to survive. At times, its future seemed in doubt. Then in the year 1126, everything changed. In that year, Hugh de Payen, leader of the Templars, returned to France. There, he won the support of Bernard of Clairvaux, known to history as Saint Bernard, the most brilliant and powerful churchman of his time.
The warriors are gentler than lambs and fiercer than lions, waiting the mildness of the monk with the valor of the knight, with one soul and one heart. Bernard of Clairvaux.
Having the support of the single most influential churchman in the West in the 1120s and 1130s enabled a small, rather obscure group of men vowed to protect the pilgrim routes, enabled them to become very famous, and then they begin to attract many donations and many supporters and members.
The poor knights of the Temple soon found themselves one of the wealthiest organizations in Europe. In 1130, his ranks swollen with new recruits, Hugh de Payen returned in triumph to the Holy Land, where he fell upon the enemies of Christendom like a righteous whirlwind. By 1165, the Templars had built a string of impregnable castles along the border of Crusader lands. In battle, their fanatical courage and iron discipline stunned the Saracens. Templars did not retreat unless they were outnumbered 3-1. If the Saracens captured Templars, they beheaded them instead of ransoming them as they did less frightening opponents. Over 20,000 Templars died in battle during the Crusades. And yet, strange as it may seem, Templars and Saracens came to honor one another.
When I was visiting Jerusalem, I used to go where my Templar friends were staying. Along one side of the building was a church. The Templars placed this spot at my disposal that I might say my prayers. Usama ibn Munkid, Saracen diplomat.
There's a famous story that in a Templar church, a Muslim was praying to Mecca facing east when a recently arrived crusader came in and wanted to throw the Muslim out, thinking it was a dreadful thing for him to be praying in a Christian church. But the Templar brothers prevented anything happening to the Muslim and said that he was a good friend of theirs. So we think that they got along really quite well with the Muslims in the Holy Land.
Over the centuries, just how close did the Templars and Saracens become? It has long been established that Templars led diplomatic missions to the courts of Muslim princes and learned Arabic. They may also have had dealings with the fanatical drug-taking sect known as the Hashishiyah, whose name passed into English as Assassins.
The Templars certainly had quite extensive connections with the Islamic and the Judaic cultures. They absorbed a great deal of their cultures. It's even said that they brought the chess game into Europe.
It was rumored that the Templars' Muslim and Jewish friends were teaching them the ancient wisdom of the East. secret arts such as alchemy, astrology, and numerology. And some believe they delved even deeper into the realm of forbidden rites and knowledge. In the ruins of Templar churches, strange disembodied heads stare down at visitors. Since medieval times, the belief has persisted that the Templars may have secretly violated their religious vows by worshipping a human head. No one could agree on a description of the heretical head. Some described it as a beautiful woman made from silver and gold. Others claimed it was a bearded man with hollow, burning eyes and horns on its forehead. Still others said it had three faces and was made of mummified human flesh. For reasons no one knows, some called the head Caput 58, meaning Head 58. Others gave it the puzzling name Baphomet. Remembering the Templars' close relations with their Saracen enemies, some historians speculated that Baphomet was Muhammad and that the Templars were secret followers of Islam. But Islam strictly forbids the worship of heads or any other graven images. Then, in the 1980s, biblical scholar Dr. Hugh Schoenfield proposed a startling new theory. Schoenfield claimed to have discovered what he called the Atbash cipher, an ancient secret code based on the Hebrew alphabet. He believed that the Templars learned the cipher in the Middle East and used it to conceal their heretical beliefs in apparently meaningless words.
The Hebrew alphabet contains 22 letters. If you write the first 11 in the vertical column and the second 11 next to them, you then merely have to change one into the other. If you write down the name Baphomet in Hebrew and then transliterate it, change the letters using the Atbash cipher, you are left clearly and simply with the word Sophia. And Sophia is wisdom. It is the female wisdom principle.
Some believe the Templars secretly worship this forbidden goddess of wisdom. In the earliest days of Christianity, Sophia was revered by mystical sects called Gnostics, or those who know. Some scholars believe Sophia was connected with the Egyptian goddess Isis and other pagan goddesses of remote antiquity. In the 4th century, the Catholic Church outlawed the Gnostics, but Gnostic beliefs may have lived on, secretly cherished throughout the Middle Ages, perhaps by the Knights Templar. Despite scholarly skepticism, the belief persists that the Templars worshipped a mysterious head. There are those who speculate that the Templar head may be linked with one of history's most famous enigmas. The 12th century church of Temple Combe village in southwestern England, in medieval times, a stronghold of the Knights Templar. This humble village priory is world famous among those who seek answers to Templar mysteries. On its wall hangs a strange painting of a man's face, dated by archaeologists to the later 13th century, known as the Temple Coombe Head. There are those who believe the Temple Coombe Head resembles a famous Christian relic. The Holy Shroud of Turin, revered for centuries as the burial cloth of Jesus, bearing the imprint of his body and face. A curious medieval legend appears to link the Shroud of Turin with the Knights Templar. For the Shroud of Turin may once have been known by another name, the Mandilion.
The Mandilion is a cloth which supposedly bore the imprint of the face of Jesus. The legend surrounding the Mandilion is that it came into the possession of a king of Edessa called Abgar, and that it cured him of a sickness. And as a result of that, he converted his nation to Christianity.
According to its legend, the Mandilion was taken from Edessa by a besieging army of the Byzantine Empire. The Byzantines brought the sacred cloth to their capital of Constantinople, where it remained until the year 1204, one of the blackest years in medieval history. 1204 was the year of the infamous Fourth Crusade, when an army of European knights headed for the Holy Land chose instead to plunder the treasures of Christian Constantinople. Medieval chronicles confirm that Knights Templar were among the Crusaders' ranks. Amid the chaos of the looting, the Mandilion is said to have disappeared. But it may not have been lost. 150 years later, in 1350, the Shroud of Turin first appears in the possession of a French nobleman named Geoffrey de Charnay. Geoffrey de Charnay's uncle, also named Geoffrey, was a high-ranking official of the Knights Templar. Could the Shroud of Turin be the lost Mandilion rescued by the Templars from the looters of Constantinople and preserved by the Charnay family? Is the enigmatic head in Temple Coombe Church a portrait of the Mandilion? As in all questions surrounding the Templars, the debate remains heated and unresolved.
The image of Christ at Temple Coombe is the standard image of Christ in medieval art, and you'll find it everywhere. Bears no special relationship to the Shroud of Turin.
If the Mandilion is the shroud, and if it had been in the possession of the Templars, there is the interesting coincidence that Geoffrey de Charnay was the uncle of the man who 50 years later had the Holy Shroud of Turin. It's therefore possible to make a case that the Shroud of Turin is the Mandilion.
Whether or not the Templars once held the Shroud of Turin remains unknown. The mysterious warrior monks zealously guarded their secrets, arousing suspicion and ultimately sealing their doom. As the 13th century ended, the Knights Templar stood at the peak of their wealth and power. Their monastic empire stretched far beyond the Holy Land. Some 900 Templar centers were scattered across the medieval world. They had a highly trained, battle-hardened army and a network of impregnable fortresses from England to Egypt. The warrior monks were rumored to be unimaginably rich. They may have owned as many as 15,000 properties across Europe. Yet as a religious order, they paid no taxes. The Templars seemed to have more money than most princes. Indeed, most princes owed them money. The Knights' wealth made them the most prominent bankers of their age. To handle international transactions, they invented a medieval version of the traveler's check. They bankrolled the wars and the lavish lifestyles of Europe's kings and princes. Time and power eventually seem to have eroded the order's strict discipline. To drink like a Templar was becoming a common expression. But the Templars' power was nothing to joke about. By papal decree, they answered to no one save the Pope, and Rome's authority over them was rarely enforced. No king in Christendom could tell the Templars what to do. But even as the Templars seemed beyond the reach of any earthly authority, events were conspiring to bring about their destruction. For decades, the Templars and other Crusaders have been fighting a losing battle to keep the Holy Land. Led by their brilliant general Saladin, the Crusaders' Saracen enemies pushed them out of Jerusalem and back towards the sea. In the year 1291, the last Crusader fortress in the Holy Land fell to an overpowering Saracen force. The Templars in its garrison refused to surrender and fought to their deaths. With the Bible lands now firmly back in Saracen control, Templar armies retreated to Europe, watched nervously by Europe's kings.
After the Templars lost the Holy Land, you could, in the simplest terms, say they really didn't have anything to do. They were immensely powerful, immensely wealthy, haughty, arrogant men. It's perfectly understandable that they might have wanted to create a state of their own.
The center of Templar power was in France, the heartland of medieval civilization. Were the Templars planning to establish their own nation by seizing part of France? To this day, no one knows. Perhaps it is not surprising that as the 14th century dawned, the Templars were confronted by a new and cunning enemy, Philip IV, King of France.
King Philip IV of France is an enigma. To this day, we really don't know very much about him. He was described by someone at the time as being like an owl, sitting at meetings and staring and never saying anything.
He has been accused of being a cold, calculating, Machiavellian kind of ruler on the one hand, and a pious, devout ruler on the other hand. He's been accused of not knowing what his government was doing. He was accused of masterminding everything that his government was doing. He is probably as enigmatic a ruler as you can find in all of medieval Europe.
Philip was worried by the unchecked power of the Templars. He also needed money desperately to finance his wars and political schemes. The French monarch resolved to crush the Templars and to seize their staggering riches for himself. Yet even the King of France could not openly attack one of the Catholic Church's most prominent religious orders, at least not without the Pope's consent. Before he moved against the Templars, Philip made sure he had papal cooperation. He ordered his officials to kidnap the Pope, who soon died. The next pope also died mysteriously, allowing Philip to place his own candidate, Clement V, on the papal throne. Old and ailing, Clement would not stand in Philip's way. With lethal precision, the king struck. Friday, April 13th, 1307. Just before dawn, Philip's constables raided every Templar center in France. In one ruthless, perfectly coordinated move, every French Templar was arrested, and all Templar property confiscated by the crown.
Nothing like this had ever been done anywhere in medieval Europe. It was done, as one great historian has said, in a manner as efficient as a modern dictatorial state could do it, and probably more efficient. The Templars didn't have a chance.
The shock of the Templar arrests has been immortalized in popular superstition. Since 1307, Friday the 13th, the day of their arrest, has been deemed an unlucky day. With the French Templars in his power, Philip wasted no time in carrying out his vow to destroy the order. He charged them with no fewer than 127 blasphemous crimes, and ordered his henchmen to make sure that they confessed.
A large number of the Templars were tortured, and tortured quite brutally. One man describes being kept tied up in a pit for many months. Others were tortured on the rack. Others were tortured by having weights attached to their testicles. Others were attached to a rope, and this was thrown over a beam, and they were suddenly jerked over this beam.
In Philip's torture chambers, most French Templars admitted to denying the divinity of Christ, to spitting and urinating on the crucifix, and to kissing new recruits on the mouth, navel, and buttocks. Some confessed homosexual acts. Were any of the accusations against them true, or did the knights confess to end the agony of torture? In 1314, 7 years after his arrest, Jacques Dumolay, Grand Master of the Order, stunned his persecutors by publicly retracting his confession and proclaiming the Templars innocent. An enraged King Philip ordered Molay and 54 other French Templars burned at the stake. As the flames engulfed him, Jacques Dumolay is said to have shouted out a final curse upon the French king and the Pope, calling on Philip and Clement to join him at the throne of God before the year's end. Within a month, Clement V was dead. Near the end of the year, Philip IV was mauled to death by a wild boar. Despite his relentless persecution of the Templars, Philip never laid his hands on their immense wealth. Before he died, Clement V disbanded the warrior monks throughout the rest of Europe and gave their vast estates to other religious orders. It was soon whispered that a few Templar knights had escaped, taking an enormous treasure with them, a treasure that has never been found. When the French king Philip IV crushed the Templars in the early 14th century, he raided their headquarters and confiscated everything he found. But Philip never found what he wanted most of all, the fabulous treasure the Templars were rumored to possess. The story has persisted that on the night before Philip arrested the French Templars, a fleet of Templar warships slipped out of Paris under the cover of darkness. It is said that the Templar ships sailed down the Seine River to the Atlantic Ocean, carrying the Templars' legendary riches beyond King Philip's greedy grasp.
Did the Templar fleet have the Templar treasure on board? We don't know, but it's one way, and a seemingly rational way, of explaining what happened to the treasure. Could it just have been that somebody tipped them off, it was piled onto the ships, and the Templar fleet sailed off, and some of them went down to Portugal, and some of them went maybe up to Scotland, some of them went up to the Baltic Sea, who knows, some, it said, went to America.
For those who believe these legends to be true, one special place has revealed intriguing evidence. Roslyn Chapel, one of Scotland's most beautiful churches and a monument to an enduring mystery. Located some 20 miles south of Edinburgh, it was built about 1450, nearly 150 years after the Knights Templar were disbanded. Yet hidden throughout Roslyn's dazzling interior, carved by master craftsmen with astonishing skill, are strange symbols some say only Templars could comprehend. In one dark corner, two men seem to sit astride one horse, the ancient Templar emblem. In another, an enigmatic figure reveals a human head. Could it be Baphomet or the Mendelian? The mysterious carvings of Roslyn Chapel are proof to some that despite their official annihilation, some Knights Templar escaped to Scotland and found sanctuary there.
In Scotland, there was tension, fighting was going on with England. The papal bull suppressing the order was never officially promulgated in Scotland, and so the order, it's possible to argue, was never officially suppressed in Scotland.
Today, believers in legend carry on their quest to discover where the Templars might have gone and where their fabled treasure might still be. Others believe they have already found true Templar gold. Around the world, philanthropic organizations like Scotland's Milite Templi Scotia carry on what they say is the Templars' greatest legacy, the ideal of selfless service to God and humanity.
I think that the real mission for the temple now in this modern world is that there is a necessity for a spiritual awareness, which really has disappeared with the advancement of science and the destruction of a lot of our original beliefs.
My brothers in Christ.
It feeds the spiritual within to collectively be a group of people who believe in the same thing and a group of people that you can trust. I mean, that doesn't happen very often these days.
You being chosen to be one of the honourable company of this most illustrious and ancient order of the Templar of Jerusalem.
Today's Templar organisations are not direct descendants of the medieval knights.
Do you promise and swear by the Holy Scriptures that wittingly you shall not break any statutes of the said order or to the articles in them contained?
I do, to serve God and Scotland.
But these modern Templars are inspired by a spiritual commitment the original Templars would no doubt recognize and approve.
In the name of God, avant Chevalier.
I think the relevance of the Templar order is as strong as it was yesterday and will be in the future. It's all about developing yourself spiritually, finding your spiritual values, and helping other people to find theirs also.
Today's Templars are no longer monks, and no longer only men. They wield their swords only in peaceful ceremonies. But they do lay claim to one of history's noblest traditions, and to secrets far greater than any lurid tales of hidden treasure or shocking rites.
The mystery of the Templars comes from a knowledge of yourself. That is the greatest mystery. If you can attain that, then you will know all wisdom.
Beyond all legends, beyond all beliefs, the Knights Templar have vanished into history. Whether they were valiant soldiers of Christ, utterly innocent of the scandalous accusations which wrought their tragic end, or whether they were guardians of a secret and perhaps forbidden knowledge, a wisdom far older than the Christian religion they were founded to serve, remains uncertain. As the centuries pass, these unanswered questions about the mysterious Knights of the Temple of Solomon will never cease to intrigue us as we continue our journey in search of history.